It was 1972 when a young Kevin Kelly began taking photographs of Asia. He documented people he met and scenes of everyday life in 35 countries while armed with little more than a camera and a backpack stuffed with rolls of film. Kevin's finally sorted through the thousands of photographs he'd taken from Turkey to Japan. He's organized it and captioned his 9,000 favorites into a hefty 3-volume photo book called Vanishing Asia. The whole thing weighs some 30 pounds. Getting lost in his work is a trip back into a time that has largely passed from today's world. Kevin's back with us on Travel with Rick Steves to help make sense of what's fading away in a modernizing Asia. Kevin, welcome back.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I've never interviewed somebody who's done anything quite like this. A project over 4 decades, 5 decades. Tell us your mission, and did you understand what you were doing from the start, or did it evolve as you went through this? Because sometimes you get into something and you realize, oh, this is what it's supposed to be.
It was much more the latter. I was there as a kid with no money and a camera, encountering a completely different alien world from what I grew up in, having my mind blown by the differences and the otherness of the places that I was going to, and realizing that even though I had very little money because of the weirdness and luck, I actually had enough money to travel fairly well and to live better than most of the people that I was encountering. So I kept going and I kept seeing things, and I decided to record them in some ways using a technology called film. You might have heard of this. It was chemically developed film that was very, very expensive and unavailable. I mean, I was often the only person within maybe 100 miles who had a camera, if you could believe
right.
that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was enlisted to be the photographer at an Indonesian wedding just because I had a camera.
Right,
they said, sure,
exactly.
Come to the party.
Right. And so I was photographing, and my backpack, instead of being filled with clothes, it was filled with rolls of film.
Right.
I had 5 rolls of film at one point. And each time I took a little snap, it was the equivalent of $5 today.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it was very, so I was very thrifty. And I was very stingy about what I was taking pictures of.
It was like
of.
A day's wages for the people you're photographing.
Exactly. So over time, I realized I was capturing things that were rare and disappearing. And I decided that became a compulsion.
Right.
An addiction that I have to see more. Oh, I can't rest because in Myanmar, up in the north, there's this crazy festival where they pull the golden Buddha on a barge, and I need to be there to photograph because it's not going to be there for long.
So you had a sense that these all were endangered.
Yes, because from the very beginning, even back in the 70s, I could witness with my own eyes places that I'd been to that I returned to that they were gone.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen that. I've just dedicated my career to Europe, and I've seen that happening in Europe in a less extreme way.
Yeah.
But, you know, one cool thing about photographing things is it sharpens your eye to observe things. And I think that's been a sort of a bonus for you and all the time you've spent traveling. You're framing it. You're looking at it with a freshness. You're a lot of really extreme close-up work, the different door knockers, the different hinges. And I just love that you can find that. I mean, think about door knockers, for example. Tell us a couple of door knockers that...
a couple of door knocker stories.
Yeah.
Well, those kind of details actually came much later as I started to review. In the beginning, I was looking for a kind of majestic, canonical, decisive moment.
Right.
Almost kind of painterly views.
Like rice
scenes.
Paddies.
The rice paddies with the person picking them up in the sunset. But then I realized that what I was neglecting were these other things that no one was paying much attention to, like the door knockers or the balcony posts or the little baby carrier embroideries. Those are disappearing even faster, and nobody was taking any reckoning of that. And so I began to collect them photographically. I would just have in my mental mind a list of things. There's another little altar out next to the door.
Right.
And they're all there in Singapore or Vietnam, whatever it is. And I would say, who else is going to capture this before they're all gone? And so I would just record them.
These are the intimate little observations. When I was in Iran in a village, I learned that there's 2 door knockers on a door. One for men to hit and one for women to hit, because the person who's going to open the door needs to know if it's a man or a woman outside to see how modest they need to be.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I'm sure that they have their own little variety and diversity. And given the way of the world, I don't think that they're there for long.
No, that, and you had the sensibility to capture that. And different eurekas. I always talk about how I was in Afghanistan, and a professor sat down next to me at lunch, and he said, "You're an American, right?" I said, "Yeah." And he said he wanted me to know that a third of the people on the planet ate with spoons and fork like I did.
Yeah.
A third of the people with chopsticks, and a third of them eat with their fingers like he did. And then he said, "And we're all civilized just the same, you know."
Yeah.
And he knew I looked at him from the rich, developed world as a person eats with his fingers, not quite as sophisticated. And he wanted to make the point, no, this is what we like to do.
Yeah.
And that's what's endangered now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Although I have to say, if I go to India and southern India in particular, they're very eating with gusto in their bare hands, including formal areas like weddings and things.
See, I'm hoping that kind of tradition,
right. It's
better. I mean,
yes. We've
got hangups
that
we don't know. Yeah, play with your food. I mean, in Asia, you don't need to sit on a toilet. They know how to squat.
Right, exactly. And now they make porcelain squat toilets.
Right, and that's not crude. That's just cultural. Kevin Kelly's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves as we take a deeper dive into his epic photography trilogy called Vanishing Asia. About 40 years ago, I was Kevin's guest on his Sausalito houseboat, back when he had co-founded Wired Magazine and was editing the Whole Earth catalog. Kevin was an early force on the internet. His website includes links to his latest blog posts on futurism and his thoughts on artificial intelligence. It's at kk.org. You featured headgear. I love the headgear. I mean, that was kind of a theme for you, it seems like, across the board. Cool headgear.
When I do portraits of people, I did pages and pages, like, you know, the faces of India, the faces of Iran, whatever. A lot of people are wearing hats because that is something that people wear a lot of, and it's partly an identity marker. It's to indicate, it's not just the keeping their head shaded, whatever. Sometimes it is, but a lot of it is a mark of their identity. So I am this. I am this tribe.
Yeah, a great example of that is in the Orthodox community in Jerusalem. The hats are like, they look like hat boxes, and they come in all different shapes and sizes.
But they're really logos.
They're logos. They're saying, I'm from this rabbi or this branch or whatever, you know.
Right. And they're branding.
It's so important. So you captured that, and it's just something that when you put it together, you realize there's these common threads throughout different civilizations.
And the other thing that for me was a real trip, of this trip, and I try to capture in these images, is the time machine aspect. This was a way for me to see, and maybe the viewer to see, what it was like to live in a world before electricity, before highways. And so some of this area, you mentioned Afghanistan, some of the parts of northern Afghanistan when I was there were literally medieval towns. These are full towns with no electricity, and there was a guy who in the evening would go down the street and light the lamps, the street lamps, the kerosene street lamps, because that's what's the street lamp.
And now that would be the first thing to go, I would think.
That was absolutely the first thing to go. But it gives you a picture of what life would actually be like when there were whole towns that didn't have any signs. No signs.
And didn't have any screens like TV to hold people together in their living rooms.
At all. Yeah.
I mean, think of tea and coffee traditions around the world. That's what you have when you're not seeing the latest fad on TV. And you featured that, bringing people together. I mean, the games, the water dispensers, the big hookahs or the hubbly bubblies, you know. What are a couple of tea house or coffee house images that come to mind for you right now?
Yeah. So tea, of course, is a central Asian theme. It's one of the common connectors between Japan and Turkey was this tea culture, having tea, cha. The place of meeting, coming out to a place to meet your friends, was important because most people's homes did not facilitate that. They were too small. And so it wasn't really common that you would meet in someone's living room. You'd go out and meet at a tea house. That was the meeting, the third place. The idea that Howard Schultz picked up for Starbucks.
He says,
we need to have that in America, this kind of a third place.
We've got a, quote, housing crisis now because we all want houses that you can accommodate the neighborhood, I think. And that wasn't an option in most societies until now. You'd go to the tea house and you'd spend a dime for a cup of tea and you'd play backgammon.
Yeah, exactly right.
That's a beautiful thing. Fast food is another theme I enjoyed in your books. Anybody who's been to Istanbul probably remembers fondly the fishermen that tie the dinghy up to the harbor and it's bouncing around and they've got an open fire and they're cooking the fish and they slap it into a newspaper with a hunk of bread and you got fish fresh off the boat from the fishermen. That is probably hit some modern hygiene problems, and I don't know if they still do it. But all over Asia, we got fast food like that, don't we?
Yeah, and that's been the inspiration, you know, from the hawker courts in Singapore to food carts. They know how to do it. And actually, unfortunately, though, they're undoing a lot of that. It's becoming rarer and rarer in some places like, you know, Tokyo, where you can actually have real street food.
Is that because of hygiene, or why would they be doing
it? I think that's an excuse. But I don't think it's really true.
I think you're right. It could be an excuse, and they just want to fund the get people into
the restaurants. Don't want a guy out in front who's taking all their thing. It's an excuse. You can absolutely, 100%, do street food safely.
Sure you can. Yeah, this is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Kevin Kelly, and he's published a 3-volume collection of photographs, 9,000 photographs in 1,000 pages, celebrating the otherness of Asia and reminding us how it's vanishing. The book is called Vanishing Asia, and we're learning about that project right now with Kevin Kelly. Kevin, another interesting thing that I noticed was kind of a theme was self-inflicted pain.
There are many traditions, many religious and spiritual traditions have this idea of becoming possessed by the god and proving your possession by inflicting pain to prove that you aren't going to feel the pain, that you are kind of transcending the worldly and the suffering of the world. And in some cases, maybe even taking on and kind of almost like a taking on some of the pain of others onto yourself, that you can kind of absorb
it. You're kind of saying this is a common reason for why different religions, different traditions would all have that commonality.
Right. And I've
seen... So this holy man in India that you photographed, literally wrapping his long penis around a stick and then sitting on it.
Right, exactly. Or they'll take blades and flagellate their skull during a dance or a trance, or they have the piercing of the tongue with a probe.
Standing on one leg, people just stand around on one leg just to be miserable.
Yeah, just to prove that they have transcended the boundaries and the constraints of having a physical body, that they're kind of in a spiritual realm. And so I think some of it may be misguided at times, but others are genuine expressions of this possession. And it's not just in Hinduism. It's common in Buddhism. It's common in a lot of shamanism. It's common in Islam.
I've done it in Christianity. I've climbed the holy steps in Rome that pilgrims for 2,000 years have climbed on their knees. It's hard to climb stone steps on your knees, and you just feel the pain, and then you meditate on that somehow.
It's very similar to the Tibetan pilgrims who circle the holy mountain or come into Lhasa by prostrating. So they prostrate.
With the little shoes on their hands.
With the little shoes on their hands. And they have calluses on their head, literal calluses on their forehead from touching the ground again and again.
Well, to this day, you know the real devout, at least the Muslims who wear their religion on their sleeves or maybe real devout, that they have a callus on their forehead because of the way they'll pray.
Pray. Yes.
And it's a very fascinating thing. If you know what that callus is, it's an indication of how this person gets close to God. Eye contact is another beautiful thing in your book. From a photographer's point of view, you got to sneak a photo a lot of times.
But
if you can get somebody looking right into that lens, those are the prize-winning shots.
I have learned over the years that the best way, by far the best way to photograph people in their doing everyday habit is to stick with them for several days. Because after several days, you will become invisible to them. No matter who you are, how strange you look, they'll forget about you within 30 minutes. And then if you spend a couple of days in there, you're just photographing everything and they don't even see you. But I didn't have that kind of time to hang around because I was kind of always going forward. So I was a little more of a ninja where I learned to take pictures of people almost without them knowing it. I was so fast and quiet. But then I would ask them to get those pictures you talked about of contact. You have to have, it's a consensual thing, and that's part of the beauty of what you're seeing is them looking into your eyes and you into them.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing. And when we produce a TV show, especially in a more distant corner, is just what I call a face montage. But we have to get the subjects to look into the camera and stay looking into the camera, and it turns out to be gorgeous. Kevin Kelly spent 47 years taking thousands of photographs in his adventures across the Asian continent. Now, he's captioned and organized his favorites in a 1,000-page, 3-part, oversized book series called Vanishing Asia. We have links to his work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Kevin, it seems like there's a reoccurring theme across the board in your 1,000 pages of photographs, and it is a celebration of otherness, of the diversity on this planet. It kind of breaks my heart in America when you just come into a town and there's a strip mall and a bunch of chain outlets and fast food and everybody's eating the same thing. And from a global point of view, it's obviously happening. Tell us about why you see the loss of otherness as really bad news.
So this book, Vanishing Asian, is a celebration of otherness, of all these very diverse ways of doing common things like cooking food, clothing yourself, the kind of houses that you would decorate. And it shows that there are a huge amount of different ways to do things that we haven't really thought of before and or have been done in the past. And the reason why it's important to remember this and to be reminded of it and to be inspired to be different is because we live in a world where increasingly how we do things converge on the same thing. We have the same curriculum in school all around the world. Everybody in the world studies the same thing. Everybody wears sneakers. Everybody's wearing basically the same t-shirts, listening to the same music, using the same technology. And yet we know that the real engine of innovation, creation, and wealth generation in the world is coming from thinking different. I mean, that was the Apple ad. So we want to be able to think differently, and to think differently, you have to have different ideas.
And in the hope, I would think, is this traditional Asia that you've documented, it's going to pass. But maybe the essence of that can live on as Asia moves into the future and as we probably follow Asia moving into the future. And clearly in our world today, otherness is subversive. You know, they want us to be the same, fall in line. Yeah. They'll even have advertisements saying this is how you be independent. And we all are losing our otherness in our effort to be independent on their standards. To me, it's really poignant how nomadic lifestyles are just not viable because they're other.
Yet we have digital nomads, and maybe they can be inspired by some of the nomads of old and what they did and how they lived. And that's the point, is that some of these ideas are going away, but they still have seeds of what is new and what we could be doing. And they are both inspiration to, and in some cases, ideas that can inspire us to be different in the ways we're going to have to be different in the future.
That's the value of travel, to get out there and see that and then to celebrate it and bring home an appreciation of otherness, rather than a fear of otherness.
Right, to embrace it. And that's what this book is. And it's a way of kind of traveling to distant time periods and places in the world that are hard to get to now. You can look at the book and have a journey of 9,000 images.
Kevin Kelly, thank you for turning in your paper after 47 years, Vanishing Asia. And I've sure learned a lot from it. Thanks, Kevin.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Kevin Kelly explains why the future belongs to optimists in a TED Talk he posts at kk.org. Coming up, it's a starter course on the sometimes embarrassing confusion that might gobsmack us Yanks and Canadians when people in Britain use terms we don't quite understand. But first, tour guides from England help a couple of our Travel with Rick Steves listeners to finalize their travel plans to Britain.